In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations time, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. There aren't very many notable rock and rollers left from that first generation of the 50s. You can certainly count them on one hand. And I can't think of a single outside of Dion DiMucci, who still records and performs regularly. The King of the New York Streets is currently 86. And last year he published his book, The Rock and Roll Philosopher, and his companion album is home to our recent coolest song in the world, In a Heartbeat of Time. We'll give it a listen, and afterwards I'll be back to speak with Dion about his rock and roll philosophy and his career on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
It's 5:50, soon she'll be passing this way. She walks by and smiles, I forget what you say. And I see you're lonely and cold and a little in me. Oh, I want you just turn around. She walks on down the street.
In a heartbeat of time. In a heartbeat of time.
For an extra coolest conversations in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. My guest is the legendary Dion DiMucci, singer-songwriter whose career dates back to the first generation of rock and rollers. More recently, he's released several albums since 2020, including Blues with Friends, Stomping Grounds, and Girlfriends, all of which draw on the blues. Well, his latest, 2025's The Rock and Roll Philosopher, is a companion to his book of the same name, covers his rise to fame, struggles with addiction, long marriage, musical influences, got reflections on art, faith, the evolution of rock and roll. It's got tributes in there as well to him, written up from the likes of Stevie Van Zandt, Eric Clapton, and others. The album contains new songs, re-recordings of older ones, and is home to this week's coolest song in the world, In a Heartbeat of Time. Dion, welcome back to the Underground Garage.
It's a joy to be with you. Great to be here.
Oh, man, thank you. You know, I really want to go out to dinner or lunch with you sometime, because in the book, you and co-author Adam Javelin have all these great conversations, share all these wonderful anecdotes when you're breaking bread. So what is it about that ritual that's conducive to sharing and reflecting and storytelling?
I don't know, you know, it's an Italian-Jewish thing, Adam. Adam's been in recovery for like 30 years, and I've been in recovery 58 years come April. We go out and we tell each other these stories. We reflect on life events, and it always comes out with a life lesson, you know, what, you know, to take us to a higher reality or to, you learn things in situations. So one day I'm having lunch with Adam and I'm telling him this story. He says, Dion, I wish my family, my friends were here. He said, these stories are so unbelievable. I mean, everything from Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson and, you knew Buddy Holly and all the, you know, and you're like a first generation rock and roller, and these stories about Springsteen at the Phil Spector sessions, and we should document these things, do a book called Conversations. So we started documenting these conversations, and 5 years later we had a book. It's a lot of fun to read. You know, they're vignettes. It doesn't read like Gone with the Wind. They're just short stories. So when we finished, we got really inspired to do an audio book. So when we were doing the audio, you see, the book has like maybe 160 pictures. The audio book has maybe 30 to, I forget the number of songs that are in it, that we some of the stories, we put songs under the stories, we introduce some of the stories with songs. So it became, so we took these songs and did a companion album to the book, and it has songs from a lot of different eras, you know, like, I have like Take It Back with Joe Bonamassa, some of these, the blues albums I did during COVID. Mark Knopfler's on Dancing Girl, and Eric Clapton is on If You Want to Rock and Roll. And I did a new song called New York Minute, and I'm Your Gangster of Love is a new song. And Cry and Shame I did with Sonny Landreth. And, you know, there's just all kinds of... I did a Tom Waits song called Serenade, which I love.
Well, I was going to ask you about, we'll get to that in a bit. I really still want to focus a little bit on the book, because my takeaway from it is that the core of your rock and roll philosophy really rests on your faith in God. And among those, well, to me, among the main tenets that you're expressing is, you know, forgiveness, taking full responsibility for one's actions, continuing to sort of work on yourself. And there's more to it, and there's also nuances with all of that. But is that a starting point, at least, to the core of your philosophy, your rock and roll philosophy?
Yeah, Manfred, you know what? Like, I got sober when I was 28 years old, and I had to get some tools to live, because I had a gift for writing songs and music. It was, I mean, this stuff just used to overwhelm me. It's just a gift, and thank God for it. But life is the art, and you know, you can die with this gift if you don't know how to live. You know, so I had to learn how to live. I started surrounding myself with some people who I really like, just inspired me the way they ran their lives, you know. And I started to see that your philosophy is perfectly designed to produce the result you're getting in life, you know. And philosophy, a philosopher loves, is a lover of wisdom. And a philosopher is somebody who makes good distinctions. If you're making bad distinctions, it's bad philosophy. So I started learning just how to run my life to get some peace, because, you know, I was like at the top of my profession in 1963. I was the first rock and roll artist signed to Columbia Records, which is now Sony. But, you know, right before Dylan came up, and I mean, things were going so well. But personally, in my personal life, man, it was a disaster.
That all comes to a head like in 68, right? That was the big...
Yeah.
You were going to kind of force yourself.
And yeah, what happened to me is I used to run the streets with Frankie Lyman. You know, we both come from close neighborhoods. And we were running the streets, taking drugs, you know, and doing all this stuff. And in 68, February of 68, he died of an overdose. And it just, it just hurt me and rattled me and filled me with such concern or fear. I don't even know how to explain it, but I just knew something's wrong. I have to stop. I can't keep doing this.
And you were married. You and Susan were married at that time already, right?
Yeah, I was married. I was married about 5 years. I got married in 63. And yeah, so.
And I bring that up because she, there was something about, you give several steps that she was like applying and, you know, sort of like bringing this to your attention and then sort of walking, sort of withdrawing, sort of to get you to see what was going on and to put you on a path to try and break the cycle.
Yeah, I love this girl. You know, I she's like my childhood sweetheart. We're still married today. You know, it's like 63 years. She, one day, I could get into it in detail, but one day she told me, she said, "Listen, Dion, I'd go to hell for you and back. But if you keep choosing to use this crap and choose to drink the way you could go to hell for yourself." And she turned around and walked away. And it wasn't even what she said. It was how she said it.
Yeah.
That really bothered me. It really, she said it with like scorn or just a sound in a voice, which she I didn't think she was capable of talking like that. You know, the attitude, it just hurt me. And I motivated me to seek help. And in April 1st, 1968, maybe a month after, you know, Frankie Lyman died, I got help and I've been clean and sober ever since.
Let's talk for a second about, because we brought up your wife, Susan, and, Runaround Sue. And I thought that was a great anecdote in the book. Can you explain that? The genesis of the song?
Yeah, Susan moved into the Bronx from Vermont when I was 15, 16, okay?
Yeah.
And now, who moves to the Bronx, Manfred? Who you're either born there or you move out of the Bronx. You don't.
Was
move
she from there. Vermont? Is that right? Something about her being from Vermont.
Yeah, she lived in Randolph, a real small town, you know. And she moves into the Bronx, and to me, she was totally exotic. You know, red hair, farm girl, like, you know, I just fell for her. And, you know, in my neighborhood at that age, like when you told the guys, I was in this gang called the Fordham Baldies. When I told them, you know, "Hey, I saw her first. That's my girl," you know. So it was understood, you know, I got dibs on this girl. You know, everybody else, you know, keep your eyes and hands off of this girl. So, you know, we were kids. I didn't know how to communicate. And, you know, I started, you know, I took her to the Paradise movies up on the Concourse in the Bronx,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like the Champs-Élysées of the Bronx. And we went to the Paradise and, you know, that was it. And that week, we had a feast on 187th Street, which Montcalmel Church was holding, you know, every year. It was like St. Gennaro's or something, you know, and they had this feast in the street, and she was talking to somebody. And the guys in my gang, they came up to me, they said, "Dion, who's your girl talking to?" She's talking to that guy over there. You know, and they like got on me. They started ragging on me a little. You let your girl talk to this guy. That guy's handsome. That guy's a good looking guy. She's talking to that guy. What was she talking to him for? So when she came over, I said, "Why are you talking to that guy?" You know, and she said, he asked me for directions to the Bronx Zoo. So I said, "Why are you talking to him?" I didn't know how to handle it. So yeah. I wrote a song. I wrote Run Around Sue. You know, I put it in a drawer somewhere. I left it alone for like a while.
Yeah.
But then later on, when I got a contract, I didn't have a contract at the time. A couple of years later, I have a contract. I did I Wonder Why, Teenager in Love, and Where When, you know. And then the Belmonts and I split up because they wanted to sing all this smooth music. And I said, no, that's not for me. And Susan said, you should do that song that you played for me, you know.
So you had played her the song.
Yeah, I played. Then I did it at I had a laugh over it and I played it for her. And she said, I can't release that. She said, no, you got to release that. That's a great song. She said, that's a great song. Release it. So I did it, you know, and I'm glad she told me to release it.
You know, there's what's cool too, you know, you have a lot of vignettes in the book, anecdotes. Right now there's a lot of divisiveness in the country, and there are other times in the country we've suffered periods like this. But in the book, you've got some great stuff there talking about time that you spent with Sam Cooke, and you mentioned Cooke a couple months ago along with Jackie Wilson. But can you tell us about your time that you got to share with Sam Cooke and how that relates to your overall philosophy?
Well, you know, his father was a preacher, and he used to try to live out a life of brotherly love, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he was trying to change the world through his art, through his music, but most of all through brotherhood, the way he lived. And I was on a tour with him and Little Willie John and, I forget. What's his name? I'll think of it in a minute. But Bobby Blue Bland. How can I forget Bobby Blue Bland? This guy was like the best. I mean, my wife just loved watching him, you know, just loved his set, you know. But Sam Cooke, during that tour, people would say things to him, especially when we got to Memphis. And I was from the Bronx. Like I said, I didn't know how to communicate. I didn't get it. I was like, hey, Sam, why don't you rap that guy? Give this guy one shot right upside his head. You know, I'm like, what are you doing? Why you let somebody talk to you like that? And he said, Dion, you know, look, that guy is peculiar. You know, when you're trying to get over on people the way he is, that's peculiar. Trying to think he's better than me because of his skin or something. So I would watch him deal with people on that tour, and it amazed me. And I didn't know where he was coming from. Then, after about 3 weeks, I figured it out that he was the brightest guy in the room. And the way he responded was incredible. He used to kind of flip things on people. How could I say it? It's like Bishop Tutu, who is black. He was walking through the streets of India, you know, the back roads, and they had this, over the mud, they had this slatted wood, you know, to walk on to keep your feet dry, because there was mud all over the streets. And he was negotiating this path one day, and this big white guy comes walking towards him, and he stands in front of him, and he says, I don't make room for gorillas. And Bishop Tutu stepped off the slats, the boards, and gestured broadly and said, I do. And he let the guy go. So it's like holding up a mirror to such ignorance, you know, or like Mother Teresa. She grabs this kid who's starving, and she brings him into the bakery, and she says to the bakery owner, do you have anything for this young lad? And the bakery owner spits in her face, and she goes, well, thank you for that for me, but do you have anything for him to eat? You know, and that's the way he would, like, respond to things, you know. He would, like, hold up a mirror to such stupidity, you know? So I learned a lot. And actually, when I saw Green Book, I knew I had another song in the back of the drawer somewhere. It was called Here in America. It was a song about Sam Cooke, and I recorded it. You could Google it, Manfred. I put it on an album called Blues with Friends, and I did it with Paul Simon, and Paul got it, that it wasn't a song about segregation or integration or bias, or it was a song about brotherly love. So, because Sam Cooke used to take care of me in the South. I went into the black section with him one night, Susan and I did. She was on the tour with us.
Yeah.
And we went into this section because James Brown and the Flames were playing a small club. He wasn't popular at the time. And Sam Cooke said, "You got to see this guy. He's really good." And he took us to this club. And some people, you know, some of his, you know, the people in that section started getting on Susan and I, our case, you know. They were like, who are these, you know, O-Fays you're with, you know. And Sam, like, they're with me, leave them, you know. But he took care of us. It was like the opposite of Green Book.
Wow. Talking about Sam Cooke, then you've got a section in the book where you list a whole bunch of different artists and sort of what you learn from each of them. And I wanted to ask about two of them because I'm not that familiar with them. One is Nino Tempo, who has a sister like April Stevens, and I know he worked with her. And I think, what do you say about him? You said you learned to overcome the fear of people, is that it? What did you learn from Nino Tempo, and who exactly was Nino Tempo?
Nino Tempo was a great horn player. In fact, he just died in his 90s. We were friends until the very end of his life, and beautiful guy. He was Phil Spector's roommate in college.
Oh, wow.
But he was a great musician. And when Phil Spector was producing me, I got a little perturbed one day. You know, you could push me so far, and then I got to confront you. You know what I'm saying? I'm from the Bronx.
Yeah.
So I went to confront Phil Spector, and Nino Tempo called me over. He said, "Come over here." He said, "I see where you're at." He said, "If you want to talk to Phil, don't challenge him in the control room. Because Bruce Springsteen is there, you got Jack Nicholson, you got Cher, you got Greg Allman in there, you got Stevie Van Zandt in there, you know. Don't confront them in there because you're going to lose. He can't handle that if you want to confront. Don't do it in the control room. Call him outside, get him in a small room across the way. There's some small offices. Talk to him privately." So now, you know, like I told you before, I didn't know how to look. I knew how to punch people in the face, and I knew how to run. I knew how to talk about people, but I did not know how to look somebody in the eye and talk about what was bothering. I just didn't know how to do it. I had no idea how to do that. And he told me how to do it. So I took Phil Spector and I said, "Come, Phil." And he didn't want to come outside the control room.
Right, because that's where he's king, you know?
Yeah. I said, you got to come out. I'm not going back in there and singing until you come out. I got to talk to you. I had a struggle. He came out, and I got him in an office, and I looked at him, and I said, "Phil, this is Dion here. I love you. You're my friend. I want to be treated like I treat you. I got to walk out of here with my balls. For me, not for anybody. I don't care about anybody else." I'm like, you know, and he cooled right down, and we were alone. And, you know, he wanted to help, and he just got, ever since that day, I talked to him in that little office, and I told him, you know, "I'm here to make a record. I'm not nothing else. I love working with him. You know, we all love you, Phil. That's why we're here. You gave us so much. That's why Bruce wants to. You know, we grew up with your stuff. We just. That's why we're here. We respect you, man. I was good to him. I didn't put him down. I didn't make any ultimatums. I didn't do anything like that. I just talked to him like a man. And that was the day I say Nino Tempo got me over the fear of people, especially talking to men. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. One other artist on that list I'm not familiar with, Buddy Lucas.
Buddy Lucas played...
Sax player.
Yeah, another sax player. You picked the two greatest sax players. Buddy Lucas played the solo on The Wanderer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, he was a very spiritual guy.
All right. Well, that ties in.
Yeah, he taught me a lot. Thank you for mentioning him. I have a play that... It's called The Wanderer, and they're doing reading actually this month in January. And Buddy Lucas, you can't put every character you've ever been inspired by in the play. So a lot of it is under one. We have a character in the play, which is a real guy, Willie Green, who was a janitor. But there's a lot of stories that we kind of combine and just put them with Willie. And Buddy Lucas is right there with Willie Green. You know, a lot of the stuff I learned. Because he had overcome drink and drugs, and he was real. He didn't try to get over on people, manipulate people, coerce people. You know, he just was a very real guy with a lot of love and consideration. And he was one of the most considerate guys I've ever met. And he taught me so much in the sessions I did with him. And I love the man, and I miss him.
And those sessions that you did with him, did you go back and use him over the years?
He played on Run Around Sue. Yeah, he was my guy, you know. In fact, I think Bruce, you know, kind of picked up on that Big Buddy Lucas was, how do you have a rock and roll band without a sax player?
I agree. That's like the missing link, you know, between like rock stuff and R&B, jump blues. You're going to mix all that in. I love it.
You picked out of all those guys, you picked the two sax players. That's crazy.
Well, a lot of the others, you know, are very, very, very famous and well-known. You know, I mean, you start off the list, I think, like with Hank Williams, and there's Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Bo Diddley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bobby Darin, you know, Bob Dylan, Big Joe Turner. Those are names I think most people are familiar with, but Nino Tempo, not so much, and Buddy Lucas, not so much. So we got to give some air to those guys. So the companion album, Rock and Roll Philosopher companion album, you're drawn from tunes that you featured in the audio book. So, and our coolest song in the world this week, I want us to talk about is In a Heartbeat of Time. And that's one that you wrote with the late Scott Kempner. Is that right?
I did. Yeah.
And so we know here in the Underground Garage, we know Scott primarily as being a member of the Dictators and also, you know, being the main guy in the Del Lords. How did you meet Scott? How did your orbits come together? I know there's something about you guys had a band together, the Little Kings.
Yeah,
What's the story with you and Scott?
Oh, man, I miss him.
Yeah.
Much. He was just the quintessential rock and roller who flew under the radar in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
He was brilliant, brilliant arranger, and he was wonderful with lyrics and just concepts, you know. And man, when he played guitar, he was all out, you know. It was just no holds barred, you know. He was just free abandon. He just he dug in, man. It was like he was rock and roll, you know. He was rock and roll. But somebody had given me a tape of Scott Kempner, and it was in my trunk for about 5 years. It was a cassette tape.
Yeah.
And one day I said, what's this tape doing? I threw it in the machine, you know, at the time. It was like the early 90s. And a song called You Move Me came on. And I thought, man, this thing rocks. You know, who is this? And I looked, I read a little, you know, the copy that was on the cassette, found out it was Scott Kempner. I made some calls. I said, hey, let's meet. He lived in the East Village. Drove downtown. We went out for some pizza or whatever, you know. And we got along so well, we just started a band. I said, we have to write. We have to do something. So,
and that was the Little Kings.
That was Dion and Little Kings.
Okay. Okay.
And we wrote maybe about 20 songs. I had a little apartment uptown across from Stevie. Stevie Van Zandt lived on 57th Street. I lived across the street at the Colonnade. And Scott and I wrote about 20 songs right there. And we went out on the road with Frank Fornero and Mike Maceres, and we rocked. We had this, it was like a half a year we did this. And Rich Neeson came into the Mercury Lounge. That was our last gig on Houston Street with a little tape recorder set up. I think it was 5 tracks. And he recorded us, and we have an album called Dion Little Kings in New York Live.
And that is that cut off of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
This is like mid-90s.
Right, okay.
And I had put the song in the order, somewhat in the audible book. And, you know, I said, this album is a companion to the book.
Yeah.
And so I picked the songs that would best represent the book and some of the stories. And some of the songs are songs that really never, that maybe my fans have never heard. Like, you know, they've just kind of been buried somewhere. This is one of them. I mean, I love that whole album, but In a Heartbeat of Time, you know, reminds me so much of that period. Scott and I used to hang out on the streets and watch the beautiful girls go by. And this one beautiful girl, we said, man, you know, and we started writing about this something in our imaginations. And the whole song is about this girl. And
well, you mentioned him writing the lyrics, and the lyric that I really love in there is, I got the quote here. Oh, what you lost in a dream, you'll find in a heartbeat of time. Did you write that, or did he come up with that line?
I don't remember who wrote what, but Scott was, like I said, he was incredible with lyrics. You know, he wrote some great stuff, and he probably wrote it. He had such a gift for arranging and lyrics. That was and the way he played guitar with great abandon, free abandon. I don't know, it's just a touch, you know. It's like Mark Knopfler has a touch, Clapton has a touch, or you know, you could hear it. And Scott was one of those guys. I could hear the way he plays. You know, he just was very forceful. That's a ballad, but he played very forceful.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier this, you incorporate this Tom Waits tune. I guess his version of the song is San Diego Serenade. And on the album, you have it as Serenade, Come to the Cross. What was the impetus to take his tune and sort of work with it?
Well, that's a great song. You know, basically it says, sometimes you don't know what you have until it's gone, you know,
right.
You miss, and you go, wow, I had this beauty and I didn't recognize it. You know, if I only recognized it, you know, while it was happening, you know, I love that song. It has great lyrics, you know, and, I wrote a song called Come to the Cross that was about a great mystery, and the bridge in it worked so well with Tom Waits' song that I had to throw it in. And I love doing that song. I go to this church down here on where I live, and I don't know where Emin's from, but this young violinist is in the church. This guy's great. I told him to come over and play on it, and he did. I'm telling you, this kid could play. He make you cry. He could make you cry when he plays.
Now, does Tom know that you did his tune?
I don't know. Do you have his number? I'll call him.
I'll work on him after we hang up here.
Tell him to listen to that version. I think he'll like it.
I know he's going to like it. You know, while I was listening to your re-recording of King of the New York Streets. And I went back and then I listened to the version from, what is it? It's off Yo Frankie. Is that what it's on? Yeah. And man, the newer one has just got more of a little bit more gritty, a little more edge to it.
Well, it's live. That's Little Kings. That's Scott Kempner playing.
Yeah. Yeah, man. It's great. And also your vocals are just, there's a bit more of a raspy edge to it. Yeah. So it's, of course, it's live.
Yeah, we were live at the Mercury Lounge. You know the way it is when you're in a club and people are right on top. You just get motivated. You know, you just want to reach people in a more more direct way, you know. And, yeah, I agree with you. It's more about what the song is about, you know.
I love the way you're trying to reach people. I mean, that ties to your philosophy, right? Taking people on a journey.
You know, Manfred, when I was 11 years old, 10 years old, I heard Hank Williams, and then a little after that, I heard Jimmy Reed, and man, it changed my life. It just, you know, my parents were always arguing. My father never had a real job. It was pretty brutal in my house, and I heard these guys on radio, and I started collecting these records. I got a guitar, and it took me into a place of enchantment. It transcended all the arguments. Like I call it a higher reality.
Mm-hmm.
It took me to another place, and my whole life, I've never really changed. My whole life has been trying to write a song and create a song in the studio to transmit that feeling that I felt when I was 11 years old to you and to others. You know, so I've been trying to do that all my life, you know, and I kid you not, this actually happened. I was at Joe's Pub one night with my guitar.
Where's Joe's Pub? Where's?
Oh, it's right in Manhattan, but I don't know if it's still around. I was doing the set, and during the set, I was telling this story, how I wanted to roll like Jimmy Reed. I wanted to communicate like Hank Williams, and I wanted to take people to a place of enchantment like they took me when I was 11 years old. And Kid Leo, who was a disc jockey, and his son come backstage, and his son was 19 years old, and he says to me, Dion, you know that story you told about Hank Williams and Jimmy Reed, how they moved you, how they did something to your insides? He says, you do for me what they did for you. And I thought, okay, I could die now.
You mentioned for a second ago, you mentioned, you know, your parents and their sort of relationship, and your dad and your mom. And I know in the book you talk about, you know, get these honorary degrees, and you mentioned that no one in your family had gone to college. Yet your father seemed to be very well versed in arts, especially like painters. And he impressed that upon you. You have a love of different painters. What accounted for that? What had your dad so attuned to the arts? And
well, you know, he wasn't like a father. I don't know what he was, but he was a marionette, a manipulator of puppets,
But really, I mean, he did. I saw a picture. Maybe there's a picture in the book of him with a puppet.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I'm saying is that he wasn't like a father figure, yeah. But he had great qualities. He was artistic. He was athletic. He could walk on the edge of the rooftops, on his hands. And he could sculpt, and he could paint, and he used to take me down to the museums, whether it was the Museum of Modern Art or Natural History. And, you know, he would, you know, as a youngster, he would put me on his shoulders and, you know, take me through this. I remember I was in my young teens, just had turned a teenager, and we went to the Museum of Modern Art, and he was showing me Salvatore Dali, how Salvatore Dali is like a draftsman, and Van Gogh is like an expressionist, can't wait to get the paint out of the tubes. He actually puts the paint on the canvas, right with the tubes, you know. He didn't even put it on the brush. So, you know, we bought these art books, which I still have. You know, they're huge art books. They were on sale. We bought about six of them. You know, Renoir, Cézanne, Monet, Picasso, Van Gogh, these different, Modigliani. So I always grew up, you know, reading these books and looking at the paintings, the photos of the paintings. And I always identified with expressionists. I consider myself an expressionist. Like if you listen to Gangster of Love, you could hear that every syllable comes out of my mouth lands in the right place. I just do it naturally. I don't know what it is, but I kind of inhabit the character that's singing the song.
Right.
And Billy Gibbons told me that. He said, Dion, I don't believe how you don't do anything wrong. Everything is right in the right place. And he said, I don't mean perfection. I just mean rhythmically and expression-wise, it's just perfect.
And now that's the opening track to the album.
Right. And I wrote that. I got to tell you the story behind that. This is great.
Dude.
Yeah, I grew up to, you know, Humphrey Bogart and Jimmy Cagney and, you know, Edward G. Robinson, you know, playing all these gangsters, you know, Al Capone and Lucky Luciano and, these guys. And I've always loved the satire behind The Wanderer, you know, like,
right.
You know, I'm the type of guy that likes to roam around, you know, I'm a man, you know, the Muddy Waters kind of thing, you know, Hoochie Coochie Man, you know.
Right.
I can make love to 1,000 women in 5, you know, just, you know, this kind of over the top bragging rights songs.
Right.
I just love them. I fell in love. And every album I make, there's got to be one of these songs on it. And Gangster of Love, you know, King of the New York Streets is one of them. The Wanderer and Gangster of Love falls into that category. You know, I'm your gangster of love.
Well, that's a great one. We're gonna go out with another track off the album. I'm gonna ask you about this cut in a moment. But you had mentioned the your stage show, the Wanderer. And what is the status of that now? Where is it? Is it being currently performed? Is it going to go head out to the Great White Way? What's the plan with the Wanderer?
Well, you know, Stevie Van Zandt and Maureen joined the production team. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be up in New York next week. I don't know. This is they're doing a reading for the theater owners. And hoping that the next step is the Great White Way, you know, the Broadway. We get a theater. So everything is done. The music, the scenery, everything. We got it's complete. There's nothing that has to be done. we have the cast, everything. And Stevie and I loved working on it. So he's amazing, man. He's got great concentration and insight. And I just... he did a lot of the music coordinating and, you know, segueing, you know, making sure that everything we did, like, had to do with pushing the story forward an inch or a mile, you know, however you do. But he's great to work with. So, yeah, hopefully Broadway, next step.
That sounds good. All right, so take a listen to one more cut off of The Rock and Roll Philosopher. I'd like us to hear New York Minute. It means, you know, reminiscent of that late 50s, early 60s kind of material you were doing back in the day. How recent is it? Did you write it a long time ago, or is it more of a recent?
No, I just wrote it recently. I just, just to... kind of get a taste of, you know, what I grew up with in a way, you know, like the kind of a look back. But I love it. I think the lyrics are just a lot of fun singing, you know. I love the way words come out of my mouth, you know, if with the vowels, you know, you're enjoying it when it just rolls out of you, you know.
Well, it sounded like it came quick. Was the song a quick one, or did it take a lot of finessing?
Not too much. No, it was like those songs come pretty quick to me.
Yeah. You know? In the lyrics, you got talking about she's got green eyes. So what color are Susan's eyes?
Green.
How about that?
No, I love this girl more today than I did when I first met her, and that was a while ago.
What is the phrase you use in the book? You mentioned this, like driving you sane. She's been driving you sane for how long?
Yeah, I say my wife drives me sane.
Man, Dion, thank you so much for making this such a very, very special Coolest Conversations.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Man, we're going to take a listen now to a New York Minute. It's Dion off his recent album, The Rock and Roll Philosopher in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Rock and roll legend Dion here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with New York Minute. And the tune is from his latest album, The Rock and Roll Philosopher. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Dion for making this such an extra special Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. English singer-songwriter Mark Valentine, he's got a new single out on Wicked Cool titled NYUAD.
standing for New York Unidentified Anomalous Phenomenon. We'll find out all about it next time around on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Whoa.
You took the red girl right out. Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.